As one who knows of Concordia Seminary through the news media, I believe it's a distinct pleasure and honor to be here this morning. I think I feel a little like Daniel must have felt when he approached the lion's den. He thought he could calm them, but I'm sure he wasn't all that certain. I'm equally sure, however, that somewhere along the line, someone will feel that I am indeed a heretic. You will be wrong. I am not. I'm an Episcopalian. One of the nifty things about being an Episcopalian is you can't possibly be a heretic, because in our 400-year history, we have had a major movement in the church that has adopted just about every stance anyone could possibly embrace. There is one thing that Len Werfel left out of that fancy introduction, which I would like to make up, because it would set the frame of reference from which you must hear this rather hard-hitting talk. It's a terribly important thing that you know that aside from these professional qualifications, I also love the church, and I'm involved in the church, and I work extensively with other people, ministers, priests, who are also lovers of the church. Otherwise, I really wouldn't have the audacity to say the rather stringent things that I intend to say this morning with great sincerity. I'd like to preface this talk on death and dying with a brief discussion of the most serious difficulty I encounter in training priests and ministers to be effective pastoral counselors, that is, men capable of handling the problems of life as well as of dying. In my experience, clergy either cannot or will not see themselves as disturbers of the peace. Since enduring peace, according to the findings of psychoanalysis, is an illusion, the modern minister whose efforts are spent trying to capture it is bound to distort reality. Gradually, he becomes uncomfortable in the company of real people, and so he gravitates toward the unreal. Left to himself, the average minister will become a veritable merchant of illusions within a few years of ordination. Having thus adopted himself to his own yearning for peace and the wishes of his congregation for comfort, he is a poor student of reality. For in reality, the mind of mankind is in ceaseless, dynamic conflict. It should be stated at this point that some of the most stultifying comfort seekers I have known are found in the ranks of radical movements. While they shout slogans and spearhead programs, they cleverly avoid being taken seriously, and thus they avoid having to live with the chains they so vociferously proclaim. In their way, they are like the hellfire sermonizer who calls his people to prepare for the last days, 7 days a week. He preaches change changelessly. In the matter of dying, this dedication to the comfortable, peaceful, unquestioning, undoubting life is obviously not only an emasculating distortion of the facts of modern psychology, but of the Christian message as well. All the way from Caesarea Philippi to Jerusalem, Christ tried to impress the forthcoming fact of his death on his disciples. In vain, he tried to make it clear that life lived God's way is life lost man's way. The disciples did not hear him, and in my experience, the modern clergy do not hear him. But the apostles' deafness plunged them into despair and loneliness, an excellent position from which to learn the lessons of the soul. The modern clergyman, however, is never so alone. He need never learn. When theological facts frustrate his quest for the serenity of simple answers, he can always get what he wants from "I'm okay, you're okay." In general, however, no one gives the modern clergyman more aid in denying the facts of death than the modern physician. As a physician, I am painfully aware of the tendency among my colleagues to psychologically abandon the dying patient. On occasion, abandonment is an expression of a particular doctor's sense of failure or frustration, or perhaps even his anger. But by and large, the doctor's relative lack of attention to the mental needs of the patient, who is irreversibly dying, is a matter of well-founded medical tradition. It is a tradition in the sense that the doctor has always felt that his first concern is to the living. His obligation to the dying is to, quote, keep him comfortable. The modern physician's preoccupation with the living may seem cold, but I would remind you that the time is gone when physicians have hours to spend on physically futile tasks. Heartwarming as is the picture of a country doctor waiting by lamplight at the side of a dying child, the facts of modern life suggest strongly that there are better ways for the physician to spend his 70-hour work week. The simple truth is that yesterday's kind, sympathetic doctor rarely had anything better to do than to offer his support to the vast numbers of people he could not cure. The idea that there are better ways to spend professional time than on the needs of the dying is not a mere matter of disinterest. In spite of the penchant a few doctors have for material ostentation and regular hours, the majority are still sacrificing dedicated individuals who genuinely care about their patients. The tradition that one should let the dead bury the dead, that one's primary concern is with the living, is based on an old and accepted medical observation. It has long been observed by doctors that contrary to the way people die in novels, plays, and sermons, in actuality, most people simply fade away. The observation has never been made more clearly or by a greater clinician or by a more compassionate doctor than it was made by Sir William Osler. In his lecture on science and immortality, he writes, "I have careful records of about 500 deathbeds, studied particularly with reference to the modes of death and the sensations of the dying. The latter alone concerns us. 90 suffered bodily pain or distress of one sort or another, 11 showed mental apprehension, 2 positive terror, 1 expressed spiritual exaltation, and 1 bitter remorse. The great majority gave no signs one way or the other. Like their birth, their death was a sleep and a forgetting. The preacher," says Osler, "the preacher was right. In this matter, man hath no preeminence over the beast. As the one dieth, so dieth the other." Since the actual act of dying appears to be an almost inconsequential matter to most people, it is easy and natural for doctors to assume that the patient's best and only interest is the same as the doctor's, that is, living. It is easy to assume that people do not struggle or reflect or even want to know about their impending death because they, like the doctor, see nothing to struggle about once physical death is a near reality. As one physician said to me, "Look, the people I see die are so sick, they are simply relieved to have it over with." Doctors are utterly refractory to the idea that death is a part of living, a part worth living well. If I am correct in thinking that the relative inattention paid to the psychological requirements of the dying patient is not a simple matter of mishandling to be remedied by employing more efficient modes of quieting people's apprehensions, if I am correct in suggesting that the psychological care given the dying is largely based on an accepted observation that left to themselves, people naturally die quietly and inconsequentially, it seems there is nothing to be gained by a prolonged discussion of the matter. Since, however, doctors are as uncomfortable about death and dying as are theologians, not to mention the growing army of quasi-professionals dedicated to the perfection of better ways to give people, quote, a feeling of worth, or a feeling of love, or a sense of well-being, since all concerned are troubled, it is entirely appropriate to re-examine the observation upon which this medical attitude toward death and dying is based. The absence of a psychology of dying in medical practice is the more obvious since most of the medical world has long recognized the enormous part psychological factors play in the creation and cure of human illness. The entire field of psychosomatic medicine is an outgrowth of the wedding of psychoanalytic psychology with physiology, neurology, endocrinology, and other fields. The application of Freudian psychology to physical processes ranges from understanding changes in the particular organs of the body in terms of psychologically determined functions to a symbolic use of an organ or a bodily function to gain a psychological end. On the subject of physical death, however, Freud's thinking does not show this range of application. On this subject, he remained close to his original and consuming wish to find a measurable physical basis for psychology. Thus, Freud's involved treatment of the subject in his work Beyond the Pleasure Principle, written in 1920, is reminiscent of his project of a scientific psychology, which was written as early as 1885. He hadn't changed that much in those years. The project for a scientific psychology was an overambitious work to which Freud passionately devoted himself before he abandoned it unpublished. In it, he sought to explain psychological phenomena in terms of measurable quantities of energy acting in various ways within the cells of the nervous system. That is, he wanted an organic basis for psychology at that time. In every psychological field other than death, Freud liberated himself from the organic frame of reference. He did not give up the notion that ultimately there would be a physical basis found for psychic processes, but in fields other than death, he energetically embraced psychological terms as the most productive of useful theory. Again, in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, Freud drew heavily upon the sciences of biology and physics of his day to support the idea that the endless, unpleasurable repetitions of memories, ideas, and feelings which he observed in certain neurotic processes were due to the operation of a, quote, death instinct, unquote. Freud assumed that the psychological compulsion to repeat was simply a manifestation of the elemental biological urge to repeat characteristics of basic instinctual life. Having observed the compulsion to repeat in persons who had suffered traumatic loss, Freud reasoned that the motive for repetition was the restoration of an earlier, more stable state of existence. The idea here is that natural biological forces always strive toward the repetition, the reinstatement of a simple state of affairs. For example, a child who has lost a parent feels compelled to repeat games which recall the presence of the parent. Freud now concluded, and not too convincingly, that the aim of the underlying instincts was also the restoration of an earlier, more stable state. Thus, it was logical, if not accurate, for him to conclude that the aim of man's instinctual life is death, that is, inorganic stability. Certainly, there is very little in these classical observations to warrant a different attitude toward death on the part of the modern physician or clergyman. If life is merely an involved way of approaching death, if our most creative thoughts and acts are only sophisticated evidences of the human animal's inexorable movement toward exhaustion and the grave, then it is entirely appropriate to leave the dying undisturbed by either religious hope or psychotherapeutic invention. All talk aside, this is precisely what most often happens. There is, however, one practical advantage to Freud's theoretical position on death. The death instinct theory reestablishes death as a natural phenomenon rather than an artificial catastrophe. This may appear to be an unnecessary effort to elucidate an already evident fact, but a moment's reflection bears out the observation that modern man does not view death as a natural phenomenon. For example, death portrayed as a vicious enemy is the best way to raise money for the cancer fund. The funeral rite has been an elaborate means by which the reality and naturalness of death is denied. Perhaps the most influential force supporting modern man's unreal view of death is the popular, if not the theological, interpretation of the future eschatology involved in the Christian faith. From this frame of reference, death may be denied as a real and present loss. Logically, if not practically, mourning is an evidence of faithlessness. It is unfortunate that Freud's theory on death is his least clinical. The idea that man is instinctually driven toward his own demise is no more difficult to accept when it gets right down to it than the existence of infantile sexuality. However, because the latter theory is so completely founded in clinical fact, the original opposition to it has long since given way to revolutionary changes in man's thinking on childhood and education, etc. No such change followed Freud's death instinct theory, and I believe this is because it always remained an intellectual tour de force and never gained the solid basis of clinical observation so typical of Freud's other theories. Ironically, in the minds of many thinkers, Freud's thanatology, that is his organic notion of death, appears to be as inapplicable that it seems to join forces with Christianity's reified afterlife in robbing man of his realization of death and thereby making investigation into death pointless. Any theory or dogma which deprives man of the knowledge of his death as a natural aspect of living closes the door to an understanding of death except in the strict biological sense. Our stumbling, uneasy work with the clinical facts of death and dying can be altered only as we investigate the subject as it is lived through by persons whose full knowledge of their situation transforms our fuzzy fantasies into living experience. In her book on death and dying, Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has done just this. She has not only questioned old observations, she has applied herself to new observations, and she has done it in a thoroughly medical way. That is, she works with her patients. As a psychoanalyst, I find Dr. Kubler-Ross's work exciting because she finds that persons who are informed of their impending death and who are offered an opportunity to participate in a thoroughly trustworthy and honest relationship with a physician become involved in a psychological process which goes through distinct stages. The stages are characterized by a dominant emotion or a psychological defense. Dr. Ross recognizes five stages, which I'll review very, very briefly. Number one is denial. This is the time, for example, when people look for another doctor for bigger and better and more prestigious clinics. The second stage is anger, a time of raging over the apparent injustice of death. The third stage is bargaining, and my religious listeners hardly need an explanation of Dr. Ross's title. It is the time when patients promise God to live a better life if he will provide a miracle. The fourth stage is depression. The inevitability of loss is finally comprehended and gradually dealt with. The sense of loss begins with peripheral things and proceeds toward loved ones and finally to the self. The fifth stage is acceptance. Dr. Ross observes that at this time there is neither depression or anger. The patient is resigned to his fate. The patient has accepted loss and needs only to be released from the hoping and concern of the family in order to achieve a death of serenity and dignity, which in Dr. Ross's book is a paramount, the final and best possible way to die, serenity and dignity. There are several important features of this work which are germane to our purposes. The people with whom Dr. Ross worked were not especially equipped psychologically or intellectually for the task of dying. They were ordinary people confronted by life's most ordinary situation. There is no reason to believe that the professional relationship offered these patients was psychiatric in nature beyond the fact that the doctor involved knew the truth and was willing to speak to the truth as the patient seemed ready for it. Even though the patients came to recognize and deal with facts which they had avoided, expert interpretations of unconscious material played little or no part in the interviews. Hence, I believe we are safe in assuming that the psychological process which evolved was entirely natural. Nothing was superimposed on the patient. He was not urged to become involved. He was not pushed toward any particular conclusion. This is a familiar frame of reference for psychoanalysts, because psychoanalysis, too, aims at the establishment, or should I say the reestablishment, of a natural process. In distinction from therapies which aim at producing particular results, psychoanalysis aims only at dissolving the mental barriers to growth which fear has spawned. The psychological growth which results in psychoanalysis differs in no essential way from growth outside of treatment. Hence, since a psychoanalytic description of growth is indeed a description of a natural process, it need not be limited to psychoanalytic patients. Psychoanalysis is simply a dramatic example of growth. It is dramatic only because the patient has for years been painfully restrained from growing, and the undoing of the fear, the guilt, and shame which have thwarted the natural processes of growth engenders intense conflict, which in turn precipitates movement. However, in this drama and intensity, it is not entirely peculiar. This drama and intensity is not peculiar to psychoanalysis. I believe this is essentially the same process which Dr. Ross describes. The equanimity which her patients achieved was a consequence of growth precipitated by impending death. The thesis of this paper is that death is simply a special example of many example of many situations common to human life which offer people an unusual opportunity for growth. It is my conviction that the aura of denial and false hopefulness which we impose on the deathbed is only the converse of the unreal aura of tragedy and gloom which we associate with death. Both are entirely artificial, and they are defensive phenomena aimed at preserving the comfortable but stunting infantile illusions which undergird so much of our modern existence. The fear of death is simply the fear of growing. However strange that may sound to the layman, it is familiar as well as sensible to the analyst. Every successful analytic patient has cried out more than once, "You're killing me. You're taking away everything that's worthwhile in life. I might as well die." This the patient proclaims, when in fact the analyst only seeks to lay bare the unfulfillable infantile wishes and the painful fears of childhood that are disguised by his debilitating psychological symptoms. The bitterness and fear which characterize the early stages of dying are often expressed with the same language people use when they are introduced to growth. Both processes involve personal loss. Hence, a patient in the throes of analytic growth describes his excruciating response to the analyst's interpretations as an agonizing death of hope. Another patient consistently associated the analytic process with a boyhood desire to live so close to the seashore that he would be constantly drenched by the spray of the waves on the rocks. The work of analysis seemed to call him away from the moist freshness of the sea toward the hot, dry city, where he felt everything beautiful and alive in him would die. A patient finishing her analysis dreamed of walking through a graveyard. Suddenly she had the urge to dig up several graves which seemed to contain cherished parts of her childhood. As she looked around for a shovel, she had the thought, "What a waste of time this is," and accordingly she moved on, because she had given up the past. Physical death itself is a perfectly easy experience to get through. Given false hope and false reassurances from friends, clergymen, and physicians in matters of unimportance, and unyielding silence in matters of consequence, most patients can glide untroubled into a state of physical deterioration in which they may remain as refractory to the facts of death as they have been to the facts of life. At this point, all concerned may relax because there is nothing more to fear. All that is left is physical death, which for most people is only an outward manifestation of the inward condition which has characterized their life. Dr. Osler was correct. To most people, death is a sleep and a forgetting. Death of this kind is not frightening. There is no real experience of loss. Death like this is comfort. In this respect, most people spend their lives dying because it is so easy relative to living and growing. Death, as it is usually experienced, is not frightening. It is the inescapably personal opportunity for growth which death thrusts upon one that is terrifying, because growth involves loss. It is the pain of intimate loss inseparably associated with growth which doctors, clergymen, and patients alike seek to avoid. Any experience that has dynamic growth potential involves some real dying, that is, a process involving an affirmation of loss. Approaching physical death is life's greatest single opportunity for an utterly personal growth, because it is an utterly personal loss. But here it is important to remember that I am speaking of growth as a process. Growth in death is not a matter of heroic surrender to the grave any more than it is a matter of stoic reflection and resignation. As I hope to describe later, faith may provide a creative context in which growth can occur, but dogmatic faith, particularly when it includes an unquestioned expectation of heavenly reward in exchange for moral behavior, is a hindrance to growth in death. The common man's Christian faith rarely prepares him for growth in good health, and so it is no wonder that he finds his death just one more frightening opportunity to be avoided. Growth is not only a matter of emotional insight and intellectual formulation. It is a process. It is a natural process, and that makes it transcendent to the efforts of the individual. Growth involves stages of progress which cannot be circumvented, even if one has the intellectual capacity to see beyond them, if the result is to be genuine. Growth is a common process available to all men who are offered circumstances which arouse an awareness of themselves and a trustworthy, lasting, and honest relationship with someone who can stand to be loved, to be hated, and rejected, and depended upon while he assists in the birth of new life in dying. An understanding of the growth process is so centrally important to a wholesome and creative view of death that I would like to illustrate it. It would be easy to draw upon psychoanalytic case material, but since growth is a common and natural process, we can just as easily examine it in non-analytic circumstances. With this in mind, let us look at the relationship which the Apostle Peter had with Christ. In doing so, it is important that the religious listener be aware that I am not suggesting that Peter's relationship with Christ involved nothing more than psychological growth. Obviously, it involved a great deal more. But in developing the notion of death as an opportunity for growth, I wish to emphasize the natural processes that are involved. If you'll excuse me a moment, I'll have a glass of water. Just like funeral party. All right. To exemplify the growth process in the life of Peter, I invite you to consider his life with Christ as a series of encounters which threatened to reveal infantile aspects of himself which had to be given up as he approached apostleship. I remind you that this giving up was and still is experienced as a death. According to the Apostle Luke, Peter's first response to the revealing nature of Christ's concern was to fall down and declare himself a sinful man. Strangely, Christ did not speak to his sins. He spoke to his fears. It is important at this point to give passing attention to the form critics. Their claim that this passage may be an amalgamation of several smaller pieces of information and may not lend itself to an interpretation as a whole. I admit to their claim, and I intend to interpret it as a whole. I suggest that Christ did not speak to Peter's sins because they were only a defense, a comfortable distraction away from the truth which Peter really feared to see. Nevertheless, Christ offered Peter a relationship that was to lead him away from catching fish to catching men. Peter's affirmation of Christ after the healing of the blind man at Bethsaida turned out to be not an affirmation of Christ, but of a messianic figure Peter wanted Christ to be. Of course, the Messiah Peter wished Christ to be would have been no threat to Peter. That is, no secret truth would have had to emerge. The fear and psychological regression which Christ's talk of suffering induced in the apostles brought out the childish bravado in Peter, not to mention the boyish presumptuousness of James and John. In the garden, Peter responded to Christ's desperate situation with reassuring nonsense. Quotes, "Even though they all fall away, I will not," unquotes. Then, like the child he was, he went to sleep. But in Pilate's courtyard, Peter saw himself for what he was. Like a brave boy, he had followed his beloved hero all the way to Jerusalem. But now it was time for Christ to die, and time for Peter to experience the death of the naive, appealing youth which he had so carefully avoided seeing throughout his relationship with Christ. Peter lost Christ as he had known him at the crucifixion, but Peter lost himself as he had known himself when he betrayed Christ in Pilate's courtyard. Peter wept and mourned his loss. Irrespective of the several occasions in which he experienced the post-resurrectional presence of Christ, he could not regain his lost esteem in his boyish self. That was dead, and Peter continued to mourn it. I suggest that part of the joy of Pentecost was the result of an accomplished mourning process. I suggest that in mourning, Peter gave up a precious part of himself and then realized that in giving up something, he had changed. On the day of Pentecost, Peter looked at his brothers and realized that through his mourning and loss, he now saw them, the other apostles, with the same kind of compassion and love Christ had expressed. Peter resisted awareness. He mourned loss and the death of a part of himself. But in so doing, he experienced the joy of genuine change. I believe that these highlights of the life of Peter demonstrate that the enormous change which took place in his life must be accounted for in terms of what we now know to be natural processes. Because it is the natural process of truth revealed within the context of an honest relationship based on facts, the growth process has predictable features. Growth is characterized by a persistent resistance to the unfolding of its various stages. Growth that is manifested in qualitative, lasting change is not the proud accomplishment of a private intellectual exercise, any more than it is the product of overwrought emotions and spiritual ecstasy. Intellectual involvement is necessary and emotional expression is essential. But the psychological death of the illusions, loves, and hates of childhood proceeds at its own slow pace, and even that is resisted. Hence, Peter resisted Christ and the moving relationship he offered by speaking in traditional terms about his sins when he in fact was scared out of his mind. Eventually, Peter gave up his protective talk about sins and took a step closer to the truth. At Caesarea Philippi, Peter opened himself to the truth a little more, but kept himself protected with fanciful expectations for Christ's messiahship. Christ's stern presentation of suffering sent Peter reeling into the most common and effective of all resistances, and that is regression. Finally, at his denial of Christ, Peter gave up regression and faced the bitter truth about himself, the truth which Christ had threatened to expose at their first meeting. Now Peter was facing facts, but fact-facing is not all there is to growth. It is only an important and essential first step. The rest is essentially a mourning process. Each childish hope, each yearning for gratification, every wish that one might avoid fear and frustration and remain a beautiful child forever, is gone over and over. Each one is raged over and cried over until it is finally let go, that is, allowed to die. In his essay entitled Thoughts for the Times on War and Death, Freud says, "The realization of death occurred when primeval man saw someone who belonged to him and was beloved to him die, for example, his child or his friend. He undoubtedly loved them as much as we love ours. For love cannot be much younger than the lust to kill. Then in his pain, he was forced to learn that one can die, oneself can die, and his whole being revolted against the admission. For each of these loved ones was, after all, a part of his own beloved self." Peter experienced the death of precisely that part of himself which he had mistakenly imputed to Christ. That is, his childish and presumptuous superiority to the conflicts of men. It was the golden hope of childhood to which the knowledge of impending death always lays claim. Since our purpose in describing the growth process in such deep detail is to compare it with the death process, it is essential that we not confuse this letting go, this death of the mourned objects and objectives of childhood, with the sanctimonious notion of a loving sacrifice. Growth, whether in full health or near death, has nothing to do with pious offerings. Growth is a resisted, powerful response to truth within the context of a loving relationship, for example, the functional Christian community. It is a process larger than the individual. There is only one truly accurate analogy to the growth process, and that is the one Christ used, that is, birth. I have chosen to exemplify the growth process with the life of Peter, not just because I am speaking to a theologically oriented audience, but also because Peter's growth included a stage which goes beyond the serene acceptance of loss. The final result of Peter's despairing and mourning of his loss of a vaunted picture of himself was not a resigned acceptance of a dull fate. It was joy. The joy of knowing that in loss and in the mourning of loss, he had been personally transformed. Analysts have long recognized that loss, particularly a loss of an immature part of oneself, must be mourned, just as a loved one is mourned at death. They also recognize that when the work of mourning is accomplished and the loss is an accepted fact, there is a bursting release of the psychic energy which had been attached to the infantile objects. The result is new energy which may emerge as joy. Joy that bursts forth from the realization of change wrought in loss and mourning is so strange to modern man that he mistakes it for the happiness of possessions and accomplishments. Hence, he misunderstands even its basic features. One of the most interesting characteristics of joy is that it drives one to share, to become fused through the shared experience of the emotion with the world around one. Emotionally speaking, this fusion is accomplished because joy, which is the result of personal transformation, also gives one a profound and appropriate sense of the relative insignificance of one's personal existence. Joy which evolves through a process of natural growth is essentially sexual, in that its fullest expression occurs at the moment of the loss of oneself. As any well-bedded couple knows, the use of syntactically correct and precise language may garble the expression of joy. The only language appropriate to joy is the language of love and of eternity. Unhappily, this is nearly a dead language to 20th century man, and so he mistakes its truth for poetic license. So far as being joyful is concerned, the great limitation of modern man is that he holds back from that which he knows to be true if it cannot be validated by the instruments currently employed by science. Of course, it is precisely this resistance to blind belief that has moved man away from magic and superstition toward knowledge and rationale. But it often also deprives him of a realization of his most basic nature. Hence, man is only reasonable when he turns away from the infantile notion of eternal life doled out in response to his puny efforts to live a good life. But one of the tragedies of modern man is that he also turns away from the joyous knowing that he is eternal, which naturally results from the final and utterly complete loss of oneself occasioned by death. Eternal life as a mode of existence, verifiable by the procedures of science, continues to elude man. But it is a verifiable fact that when men and women die within the context of a loving relationship, that has turned hoping, disillusionment, despair, and mourning into mere stages in the process of growth, death can be experienced as an eschatologic loss of oneself that occasions joy. It is joy to be expressed with Paul's words, "Sighs too deep for words." Such an event is beyond sacrifice and bargaining, heroic confessions and humble resignation. Because it is the natural result of a natural process which transcends the individual. In growth, the individual is transcended, but not excluded. The capacity for the individual for decision, for example, is not rendered inoperative by the process. But decision cannot change the process. It only changes the individual's participation in it. For example, Peter could decide to follow or to stay. Having chosen to follow at a psychological distance, he was free to see the truth or to circumvent the truth. But each time the truth was faced, he was carried along to a new stage of development where once again he had choices open to him. Of course, decisions are never made in complete freedom, but relative to the random movement of unchanging people, growing people are quite free to make decisions which affect in an essential way their participation in the growth process. The notion of a decision, as it applies to the experience of death, is the major concern of Ladislav Boris, S.J., in his book, Mysterium Mortis. In summary, he says, death is man's first completely personal act, and is therefore, by reason of its very being, the center above all others for the awakening of consciousness, for freedom, for the encounter with God, for the final decision about one's eternal destiny. Speaking of the resurrection of Christ, Boris draws from the Apostle Paul in Romans and Ephesians when he says, the resurrection procures the condition for the possibility of our salvation because it enables us to grow together with the risen body of Christ, and this growing together with Christ is precisely what salvation is. Clearly, Boris sees the death experience as an opportunity for growth, which is unsurpassed by any other event, because it is the most exquisitely personal moment of anyone's temporal existence. The decision open to man in death is to affirm or deny that death is beyond righteousness, retribution, and understanding. When all these things are given up, then death is man's first and last chance to embrace the utter humanness of his condition. But by the same token, it is his first and last chance to know that in choosing to affirm the complete loss demanded by death, there is transformation towards man's prototype of God made man, and there is also the joy of transformation. It is the passionate joy of gaining in loss that which is lost in gain. Men and women who have tried to express it are maligned by interpreters who search their words for concrete proof of the corporeal existence of their favorite fantasies about heaven and hell. Physical debility, the utter privacy of the event, and the nature of joy itself make accurate interpretation of a joyful man's dying impossible. It is an experience to be understood in sharing. It is in sharing our brother's death that we are assured that when a man mourns and affirms the final loss of his lifetime, he can know in abundance the joy which follows the thousand deaths that accompany everyday living. To minds that are strung out on dreams of milk and honey, gold and crystal, this lecture would seem to be an exercise in despair. But to men and women who dare to believe that eternity began this morning, that this is the day of the Lord, it is enough to know that St. Paul's ancient paradox still works to the joy of all mankind. What you sow does not come to life unless it dies. Thank you.